you know, we give the Gen Ys a hard time, but I don't think they're too bad. And I think, you know, as the prior generation, it's important that we empower this generation, you know, instead of just pointing the finger and saying they're like this because of that. We need to actually look at how can we empower them.
Listening to the NZPE Teacher Cast, a podcast sharing some of the inspirational stories from amazing teachers and educators within New Zealand and around the world. Today's episode is sponsored by My Study Series, an online learning platform supporting Kiwi teachers and students through NCEA. With automated self-grading quizzes after every video, My Study Series ensures students receive immediate feedback on their level of understanding. Check it out now at mystudyseries.co.nz.
Kia ora everyone and welcome to episode 24 of the NZPE Teacher Cast. Just before we get started, you might have noticed that I have shifted a lot of the content, the podcast episodes onto Facebook, so do feel free to jump onto that page, NZPE Teacher Cast on Facebook, and like the page and like the podcast. But moving on, I'm really excited to be able to interview a close friend of mine that I went to uni with. His name is Jason Costa, and he's a bit of a big deal. He is a Commonwealth bronze medalist in his sport of judo, and he has a bit of a role in tertiary education and a few other tidbits that we're gonna touch on throughout this podcast. So it's gonna be quite a cool one, but we'll get straight into it. So, Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Carl. Yeah, looking forward to it.
So, can you tell us a little bit about your background and your experience and a few tidbits about your current role in education, because you're not actually in front of a classroom, are you?
No, our curriculum is all in an online spectrum. And I guess how I got there was effectively, you know, as you mentioned, we studied together and, you know, back in 2004, I intended on going the sort of... I guess you'd say the academical science route with the sports science. But I was a little bit disheartened because I felt I couldn't help many people doing that. And while it was good to prove, you know, theories and do research papers and that sort of stuff, I think it's fair to say with sports science, it's more proving stuff that's already being practiced. So it's almost like, you know, we're there to verify that, hey, these training methods do work. And for me, I was sort of like, well, that's not really going to help that many people. Naturally, as you mentioned, I had my sporting career, so I was any work I was doing was to supplement the sporting career. But you know, I missed out on the London Olympics, came back home, and I was like, right, what am I going to do with myself? Fell into a role, personal training. From that, I got to the point where I was too busy, so I had to hire trainers that didn't work for me, and you know, one of my business partners at Fit Future said, hey, how can we get more successful trainers? And that's where basically our Fit Futures Learning Institute was born. And that we said, well, you know, let's actually organize and operate a learning institute online to help people get into the scope of the fitness industry.
That's really interesting because that online learning space is something that I'm really passionate about. And if you look at... So you mentioned being this co-founding this Fit Futures, which is a tertiary learning institute that specialises in helping students become personal trainers. There's already, I guess, physical institutes that people can go to, like NZIS, that they can upskill and, I guess, learn about this personal training and the fitness industry and exercise science and stuff like that, and they can go to phys ed school and do degrees. What's your point of difference between those? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes.
Fit Futures to the others.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And, you know, having worked at a couple of the other institutes, which I won't name, but I was pretty disheartened because it didn't feel like they were adequately preparing people, you know, for the industry. I equate it to like they were expert swimmers that had never been in the pool. You know, there was people that actually had never cut their teeth on the gym floor. And so a lot of the requirements to be a successful personal trainer are beyond just, you know, having a really good database and knowledge of the body. It's that building rapport with people, sales side of things. And then when we looked at the people that we really wanted to help, or, you know, what NZQA and TEC would classify as your priority learners, under 25 Māori and or Pacific Island populations, we found that a lot of them had moved into full-time employment, and it was not always possible for them to say, hey, I'm going to give up all my commitments, stop working, stop earning it, and go back to study. So we developed a system where basically they could work in somewhat of an internship. So the first 4 months of the education was more of the theory side of things, you know, learning the foundation and the background. And then what we did was we tied them into their local gym or their local community, which again is another big focal point with health and fitness, obviously it's changing the community. And they would get, you know, their practical experience through local gyms and as I like to term, an internship. And what's been really, really positive about it is that 80% of people that have gone on to graduate have then gone on to work in those fitness centres. So the other big link with us is we actually have that really strong industry connection, and we do a lot of aftercare with our graduates, because for us, you know, we're not succeeding if they're not in the industry succeeding as well.
That links in really well for kind of the audience that listens to the NZP TeacherCast, because we have a lot of physical educators, and in education, particularly in secondary, it's all about finding pathways and creating more authentic experiences for our students. And we see a lot of students in PE that kind of you have your academic pathway, mm-hmm. and then you have students that might not be as capable for an academic pathway, and they might not be kind of targeting that degree level study. Do you think something like Fit Futures is a viable option for our secondary PE and health school leavers?
I definitely think so, and we've worked really, really hard. You know, I've taken the course from being an idea that I had to, you know, writing all the curriculum, getting it NZQA accredited, so it's a level 4 national certificate in personal training. And as I say, it's a very much a viable option, because, you know, a lot of people, as you say, the academic pathway is not necessarily for them. And if we can get them into something like the fitness industry, there's a real passion.
Not that to be a personal trainer, you don't need to know academics. It's still, that's a
big part of it. Absolutely. But again, it's one of those things, and it's something I can attest to, is I learned more, you know, in that first sort of 6 to 8 months once I'd graduated, you know, than I'd probably learned in the last 2 years as opposed to real world knowledge. But, you know, the house advantage of me having those 4 years behind me does come into play. But, you know, as you say, it's one of those things that the academia, in terms of when you are working in a role, is usually driven by passion. And so normally, you know, if someone graduates with us, you know, they actually go on to do other study in the scope of either nutrition, final phase rehab, so, you know, becoming a specialist in that area, as well as the most common ones, you know, fat loss, muscle gain, looking good, basically. So it's definitely a viable option. And I think it is that sort of that mid ground between those people that, hey, I'm definitely going to go on to do, you know, uni level education, institute technology level education, and those that are sort of saying, hey, I'm still trying to find myself, I'm going to earn a little bit of money, and then the passion usually drives them to where they actually want to be studying and where they see their career.
That's cool. One thing I'm interested to hear your thoughts on, because because I teach in secondary, and you're seeing this, I guess, with the influx of social media and Instagram and all of that coming on board. You're seeing this Fitspiration and all these models and buff dudes, and they post their things, and all of a sudden it's popular to be in fitness and go to the gym and stuff like that. You'd see that firsthand, right?
Yeah, and you know, there is people these days, they're really quick to celebrate their own success, and that becomes a double-edged sword, because, you know, for me it's fantastic to see someone that, hey, I didn't have much confidence before, but now I'm, you know, I'm proud of what I've achieved, and I'm working towards something. But then on the flip side of it, it's we lose a bit of that long-term focus and working towards more meaningful projects. So the Fitspo movement is not bad, but like any movement, there are bad aspects to it. You know, I had a discussion with a parent the other day, and they said, oh, look, my son's gone and spent $80 on protein powder, and then he his gym membership's, you know, $15 a week, and he sees a trainer that's $46 a week. And I said to him, okay, cool. So I'm spending $140 right there on something which is actually increasing their longevity, making them a better person, increasing their health. And I said to them, okay, so would you rather they did that or that you were having them spend it on alcohol, cigarettes, and you know, things that aren't so positive? So, you know, I always like to try and see, you know, the glasses being half full. And
that's good.
Yeah, and I think there's definitely some strong aspects of it that are really, really important. And the cool thing with the fitness industry, though, is that the people that have got the why of helping people, if that's the core value, they tend to stick around. It can often be described as a bit of a flash in the pan because, you know, people are, they look really good for one show and they get some really nice photos and then they live that online presence for the rest of their life. But the ones that are really out there trying to make a change, they tend to have a stronger core value around helping people. And you know, one of my big ethoses is I'd rather have someone that's 20% body fat and happy than 2% miserable. And it's about, you know, realizing that, hey, when you change, you give people around you permission to change. And that's why, again, the social media side of thing, you know, I sort of turn a bit of a blind eye to a lot of that because I much rather focus on those more grounded people in the industry.
Okay, answer this then. Short answer.
Yeah.
Fitspo, yay or nay, the impact on society is positive or negative? No sitting on the fence. You get rid of it or keep it. What, your societal influence.
I'm going to say...
Is it good for society or bad for society?
It's good for society because now we see that health and fitness is becoming the norm in the mainstream. And you go to a country like Brazil and it's the norm. Everyone is healthy. Everyone is fit. With a little bit of vanity, though, it does become longevity. And as I say, as long as people are doing the right things. So yeah, to give you a no on the fence answer, Fitspo... Sure, I'm all for it.
Looking forward to those Instagram photos. Yeah. You're an elite athlete, and it's kind of hard for me to view you as that because to me you're just Big Jason that I went to uni with. But elite judo athlete, Commonwealth medalist, Olympic coach. What drives you to continue giving to the sport of judo after so long?
Yeah, it's one of those. I guess you'd say it's a love-hate relationship. And I think with anything that you love, there is a period where you hate it, you know, or you question it and you look at, you know, why you're doing that. And I'm happy that you just view me as not being an elite athlete and just Big Jason, because one of the things I never wanted to be known as is, oh, he's the judo guy. Or, you know, because, again, that becomes your identity. And one thing I found in missing out on 2012 was that... you know, it can be a lot of soul searching after you miss out on something, which is such an important part of your life. And, you know, one of the dark secrets around the Olympics and top level athletes is the 12 months after. You know, a lot of these guys, they have, a lot of mental health issues with depression because, you know, it's this big peak and then all of a sudden I've done it. And then it's like, oh, now what? Okay, well, that's what I've worked my whole life for. And, you know, there is a few obviously tragic stories where athletes have taken their life. And I guess one thing I've always worked hard on is, you know, there's more to life than judo, but judo is my life. And one of my ethoses as a coach is to, you know, make good people. And if they happen to be good at judo, okay, cool. In terms of what drives me to continue doing it, it's, as I say, it's just that passion. It's like, it is, I guess, my obsession. You know, it's something that every day I'm thinking about, I'm working towards. And there's a lot of social responsibility for me to give back. As you know, judo is an amateur sport. So we, you know, when we're heading away overseas, sometimes the sponsors are mum and dad, or the sponsors are the people that have, you know, watched you on that journey. And I think it would be a little bit irresponsible for me to just at the end of it go, okay, cool, pack up. I'm just going to focus on myself. Now it's a lot of it is around giving back. And you know, when you give back to so many people, it's, you find out a lot about yourself and who's really there for you. And it's really, really cool to see now this next generation come through and be quite successful. So my passion is definitely, again, you know, returning back to the helping people thing, it's definitely that, but it's also judo. It's just my love, my second love after my wife, of course. Yeah.
I think it's, you know, it's really cool to see, you mentioned kind of just being grounded and like, you know, you've put me up for the week while I'm at mass conference, and you know, it's really apparent that you like, I've got this perception in my head because it's something that I always strive to be, you know, at that Olympic level as an athlete. And you put these Olympians up there as like on this pedestal. Not that you shouldn't be on a pedestal for achieving really highly in sport, but that you almost see them as abnormal in a sense that it's beyond, it's out of reach. But then just seeing you and your wife Moira who competed at the last Olympics as well in judo, seeing you day to day, you are just normal people. You know, you're just really good at what you do, but you're not different to the rest of society. And I think that's really cool that you still manage to keep that that really grounded approach to life. And judo is your passion, and you're so passionate about it. And that's what we try to instill in our students, is they want to get good at something, and you try to encourage them to be passionate about it, not just, oh yeah, cool, I'm passionate about rugby and I've got training twice a week and sometimes I hit the gym. You know, they need to live it. Mm. And that's I think you can see that with you, and that's really cool to hear. But in terms of judo, I know nothing about judo, and I watched you compete at nationals last weekend, which you had some good results, and I picked up some interesting tidbits trying to understand some of the rules. So despite it being a combat sport, it seems that it has quite a holistic feel to it. Would that be right?
Yeah, definitely. And interestingly enough, you know, in a lot of sports, like, you know, the Crusaders wouldn't go and, you know, do a trip to Dunedin and train with the Highlanders, but judo's kind of the opposite. We all train together. We all have training camps together. And this goes on a world scale as well. We all do big training camps where you'll be literally training with your opponents. There's a lot of respect, which is, you know, being the traditional sort of Japanese martial art, there's respect always tied into that. So we're very much, it's almost like a brotherhood, in that we all, you know, we go out there, we fight, we obviously try to beat each other. But at the end of the day, it's a combat sport, but we're all going through it, so we all understand what it's like to go through it. And, you know, even as far as, you know, my last run towards Rio to try and make the qualification, which, as we alluded to, I missed out on. In one of my first rounds of a fight in Azerbaijan, I beat this American guy, and in beating him, I cut his chances for Rio. And I saw him immediately after the fight, and he was obviously quite down. I actually felt really bad for him, because I was like, man, I've just gone and, you know, taking his lunch, basically. But, you know, that's the sort of level of camaraderie that we do have, is that you're out there to beat each other, but you also feel for each other and you empathize each other, because you know what it's like to be traveling and that sort of stuff. And, yeah, as you say, the holistic thing, judo, you know, I obviously take more of the competitive element to it, but, you know, in my class, we've got people that are doing judo from a social aspect. You've got people that want that little bit of increased confidence, self-defense, right down to... you know, the kids that perhaps don't fit in society in other areas, and it's good to get some camaraderie there. So yeah, it's a bit more than, you know, the saying is judo is more than just a sport, and I think that's really true. Yeah.
While you're not in a classroom per se, I saw you at nationals and watching you compete, and then watching you interact with athletes from your club, it's clear that athlete coaching and development is a big part of, like, an educational focus for you. So focus of bringing up some of these younger athletes, do you do it in a way that encompasses, say, all aspects of ho'oda or well-being, so their physical, their social, their mental, emotional, and their spiritual well-being, or is it simply an A plus B equals C, so do this to achieve this?
Great question. And I refer back to when we developed Fit Futures, we established what we called the four posts of basically making a great person: technical, tactical, physical, and psychological. And I feel, again, you can have, and I've seen it firsthand, is that you have these, you know, people that are physically very, very dominant, you know, specimens, and they do very, very well. But unfortunately, once sports sort of chewed them up and spit them out, they have no real life skills. And so for me, or for my athletes, it's important to educate and empower them in those other areas. You know, when I talk about technical, I'm not just talking about on the mat, I'm talking about life skills. So, you know, there are times when I will challenge them. They may not know I'm challenging them, but I'll do things deliberately, but like there'll be sessions where I'm a little bit harder on them than I normally would be. There's always a lesson at the end of it. And that's teaching them to overcome adversity, because, you know, me yelling at you in you know, a club down the road is preparing you for when you go to Brazil and there's 10,000 screaming Brazilians, you know. Or more importantly, it's preparing you for when you go into your first ever job interview. And, you know, you're used to that pressure there. And in terms of the tactical stuff, you know, I'm a big believer in not just doing things because tradition dictates it. So, you know, something that we both resonate over is the 80-20 rule. So, you know, if I can put 20% of my effort in one area and get 80% of results, I can do that. So I put questions, or I pose challenges to my athletes that they need to come up with what's their 20%. and figuring out ways that they can say, hey, I might not have these advantages that other people have, but what are some advantages I can have? In terms of the psychological, again, I outsource psychologists and I get them to understand that process, because I think that is one of the most untapped areas of development is understanding the psychology. And I honestly believe until you understand someone's psychology, you'll never master their physiology. So again, with that side of things, each one of my players I have an independent relationship with. So the way I coach player A is completely different to the way I coach player B. You know, I've got a couple of athletes that are very introverted and I need to put things in articulate terms with them, and I need to say, right, this is the process behind what we're going to do. We're going to go out there and do this. This will lead to this process and that's going to give us this result. Then I've got other like little fireballs, you know, that I'm just like, right, you're going to go out there and smash this guy and it's your mat and you're going to be the boss today, you know, and we get the same results. But again, it's playing, playing your cards, you know, and it's that's a really big important thing, is that I've got to develop, as I say, great people that again will become great leaders one day. And look, at the end of the day, you know, judo is a very unforgiving sport. You know, we're in a sport where I can spend $5,000, travel halfway across the world, turn up, lose my first fight in a tournament and be done. You know, it's that drastic. So if I can prepare these guys for that and then any other challenges in life that are similar, then, you know, we're on the right track with it.
I was listening to a podcast recently and I'm just trying to think of whose podcast it was, and I can't think of it, but there was a statement made in this podcast and he basically said that it's really easy to be successful today if you are disciplined and strong-willed and of sound mind, because society has become so weak in the mind. It's just so weak-minded. Mm. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we give the Gen Ys a hard time, but I don't think that's too bad. And I think, you know, as the prior generation, it's important that we empower this generation, you know, instead of just pointing the finger and saying they're like this because of that. We need to actually look at how can we empower them. And, you know, with regards to being weak in the mind, I think what happens is that, you know, you're only as good as your options. And what happens is people these days, they do something, they get a little bit of success, they share the Instagram update about it. And then that next level is where the challenge comes. And that first point of adversity comes. And that's where, with all the options we have today, that's what breeds the entitlement. You know, and, you know, the great example of that is that, you know, my generation, the average person has 6 jobs. I worked out the other day, I've had 7 jobs, you know. This generation is 20. Mm. And because what happens is that they work in a place for 3 or 4 months. They go, I'm worth more than this. I should be getting paid more than this. I should be deserving this promotion. I'm going to go elsewhere. And then they start at the bottom of the same rung at another company. Versus if you look at our generation, it was, no, you work hard for 2 or 3 years. You work your way up the ladder. And that comes again with that instant gratification we have these days. So I think with that mental toughness, it's a case of providing, you know, samples of success for people, but also setting them then challenges on that. And, you know, one big theme which I had from my PT days is at the end of a session always be 2 positives, 2 work-ons and a laugh, you know. And you've got to show them that success that they've previously had over the last 6 months, 12 months, you know, whatever it is, and then make them realize that, hey, that success is only get a little bit further down the line. But the with regards to building that mental toughness, yeah, I think we need to take a different approach than perhaps we did in the old days, you know, because it was easy to be mentally tough when all you had to do was, you know, a very limited spectrum of things. But now, I mean, you know, if we even look at sport alone, it's like, okay, well, I can't do judo. Well, I'll move over to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Oh, no, I don't really like that. I'm moving to kickboxing. Oh, hang on, there's a frisbee golf club, you know, and it's very easy for people to, like, you know, have like a smorgasbord of choice. But, you know, when you look at the ones that are sustainable and, you know, you often find that's why a lot of people have had adversity growing up tend to be the best athletes and the most driven, because they're you know, they're fighting some demons in some respects. You know, they're trying to make a change. And that's why I do often put my athletes through a little bit of adversity. I am very lucky with the athletes I have, though. A lot of them have got very good role models in their parents, and also we've got a very good culture in the club. And, you know, culture's often talked about, but it's hard to define. And I think with the guys I build, the culture's been built because I've seen myself and my wife Moira, you know, having a crack and working hard, and they see that, hey, the leader's working hard, you know, there's no reason it can't filter down into the others. And, you know, I just remembered a fact. One of the first times I ever saw that was when one of my first ever jobs was working at the warehouse on checkouts. And I went home and I said to Mum, oh yeah, you know, the boss, he was out there moving the trolleys and that around. And Mum said to me, that's exactly the type of boss you want to learn from, because, you know, they are prepared to do, you know, the groundwork and not above anything. And then when you see someone like that, it means that, you know, you can work overtime for them. And when it comes to sport, that's exactly it. When you tell them, I need a little bit more from you, they know that you would give the same. So it's easy to build that mental toughness.
So on that mental toughness and facing adversity, there's this common theme that often appears in junior health, and that's dealing with or providing strategies for our students to deal with change, loss, and grief.
Mm.
You've now missed Olympic qualifying two times, and I can't really imagine what that must be like to get so close and miss out on something that you've spent more than half your life working towards. What strategies have you employed while being in that situation?
Yeah, you know, and again, it's still, when you say it, it still does cause a little bit of pain in the heart. And
sorry to ask you, mate.
No, it's all good. And, you know, and because it is the interesting story that people want to, you know, want to hear and I guess want to learn from. When I look at 2012, I didn't have much structure in my life and I had compartmentalized my life a little bit too much. So, what that meant is that I was, again, singularity of purpose. I was just focusing on my judo and I didn't allow myself success in other areas. And with that, it meant that when I lost in judo, it was like everything was lost. And it's funny because I look back and every time I'd lose a fight in Europe, you know, and I was going against like professionals, you know, like guys that were training full time, state, you know, funded, that sort of stuff. And I'd lose and I'd be so hard on myself. And then, you know, I was having dinner one night with these Romanian guys, and again, they just lost a few, you know, a few fights on the day, and they were just sitting down there, and it didn't even faze them. And it kind of made me start to realize that, hey, you know, it's okay to lose. But it was hard because, you know, you come from New Zealand, and we've got an interesting culture in New Zealand. It's that, you know, we, when you look at it really, we punch above our weight in a lot of sports, and we expect that success, which is, I think it's good. It's a good breeding ground. But we're very quick to tear our athletes down. And so for me, a lot of it when I was away, you know, unfortunately some people in the judo community can be quite fickle, and they basically want to see you do poorly. And so you know, because then they can say, well, you know, the old thing, the older I get, the better I was, you know. And they say, oh, well, back in my day I did this, you know. It's a different thing. But anyway, the big thing with it was like, you felt like you're letting down a lot of people when I do poorly. And, you know, even to this day, I still do. If I perform poorly, I do feel like I'm letting people down. But, you know, after 2012, we had the success in the Commonwealth Games of 2014, and that was all on track for Rio. And Rio, I was in great shape. I had, you know, fantastic personal life. Business things were going well. And then again, it just didn't happen. I still to this day can't realize it. And, you know, the phone call to mum and dad is always the hardest after I do poorly, because it's like, you know, they're my day one biggest fans. You know, they are eternal optimists for me. They want the best for me. And dad just said to me, he said, look, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, we don't like Jason, the judo guy. We like Jason, our son, you know. And it kind of really helped me put things in perspective. And, you know, don't get me wrong, there was still a number of tears and, you know, soul-searching nights and that sort of stuff. But I think at that stage, because I had so many other things going on and I didn't compartmentalize my life as well, I could allow a little bit of success from other areas to sort of filter over and help with it. And, you know, I think, yeah, dealing with loss and grief, it needs to be normalized. It needs to be, people need to realize, hey, that's part of life, you know. And losing a rugby game, you know, while at the time it is hard and it hurts and, you know, it may seem like a big deal, in 2 weeks' time, it won't actually matter that much, you know. And one of my early coaches, Fiona, who you know, she said to me after I missed out on London, she said to me, I know it doesn't feel like it, but the journey is probably more important than the destination. And it felt like one of those cliche things at the time, but when I look back on all that experience I've built up, including my loss and including the grief, and you know, when I say loss, I've actually lost a few people along the journey as far as mental illness, cancer, that sort of stuff. And when I look at all of that that I've been through, it means that I'm now in a really powerful position to help these kids. as opposed to looking up to and going, oh yeah, Jason won everything and he is always the greatest. You know, they've seen it. Hey, he took a chance, he took a punt and he fell over. But look at him, he's still going now. And, you know, I think I'm very happy with how my life is at the moment, and that's even with the losses that I did have. So as far as, you know, people that are dealing with kids, you know, you just got to normalize loss. I mean, loss is a part of life, and the more we try and make it seem like this taboo, it's the more, you know, like, I guess, abnormal it becomes. So, yeah, for me, loss is a part of it. It's not a part you want to experience a lot of, and that's why it's still good that you need to hit some success along the way. And, you know, it wasn't like I was, hey, you know, if I was trying to make the 100-meter sprints, you know, with my body, that, you know, sure, there will be a time where someone says, hey, you're losing a bit more than you're winning, you know. But, yeah, I think that's a very much an important part of life, is that, and it's got to be seen as being normal.
I like your perspective, and I like how you somehow managed to slot back in there how giving back to the community and the judo community. So it just shows where your values sit, and that's... That's really cool to hear. So on that, going from a negative to a positive, can you describe the feeling of standing on the dais to receive a Commonwealth medal for your country? That must have been insane.
Yeah, it was, you know...
I remember, I don't think I told you this, but where were you competing?
Glasgow,
that's right. And Jess and I, we'd set the alarm for all your fights and we'd get up and watch, and it was just so cool watching you. I don't think I ever told you that, but
no.
We were so proud of you.
It's funny because, you know, I didn't get the gold, and no one goes there to win a bronze medal, but a lot of people have put on a speaker and said, hey, you know, think back to young Jason, he would have, you know, absolutely loved the bronze medal. And you know, I said at the time, and I mean it to this day, and just hearing what you said then really resonates that, but the Commonwealth is always a tournament for everyone that's been there for me, and everyone that's gone through the loss, and everyone that's sort of had to deal with, hey, no, Jason can't come out tonight, he's got training tomorrow morning, or, you know, everyone that's had to ever put up with any of that. And, you know, a lot of my best memories growing up is with my gran, who unfortunately passed in 2004. A lot of my best memories growing up were watching the games, and hey, this guy's a Kiwi, hey, this guy's from the coast, this guy's from Christchurch, and thinking, man, these guys are awesome. They were like superheroes, you know, like you looked up to them and they did that. And you know, it was to win the bronze, it was it's not my proudest moment as a judoka, but it's definitely my proudest moment as a Costa. And to, you know, just to see the absolute, you know, joy in mum and dad's face, and, you know, when I came off and, you know, Moira's waiting there for me, and then the press, and it was just like everyone wanted a PC, you know, it was just like, man, you didn't really sort of get a real sense of how big it was until people that I haven't spoken to since I was a kid, you know, contacting me and saying, man, that was awesome. And, you know, I always talked about, like, you know, Christchurch had been for a lot of that stage, earthquakes, that sort of stuff, and a lot of people that are close, community have been through a lot, and just to give them a glimmer of something they could be happy about and proud about, and, you know, feel I guess a part of that success, that was the best feeling around it all. That, you know, standing out there getting the medal, you know, to be honest, a little bit bittersweet because another anthem was playing, not mine. But, you know, when it was you come home and you see people that are just, they're just so proud of you, and the pride that they wear for themselves with it. You know, the Commonwealth medals were the only medals that Moira and I ever put on display, and the reason being is that when people would come over, would say, wear it, put it on, it's your medal, it's the country's medal, it's not mine. And, you know, that was the real sense of pride of that medal.
Yeah, I mean, that's, and I think, particularly in your sport, the emotion of that bronze when you were going for gold, you lose that match, that means you're not going to get gold or silver, but you're going to either get your bronze or you're going to go home with nothing. I mean, you got to go from that to then get up for that fight, and that was hard.
Yeah, it was. The guy I fought was an Australian guy, and we've always ended up fighting each other in these sort of tournaments. I guess he got the final laugh because I lost to him as far as going to Rio. He didn't end up going to Rio either, but if I'd beaten him in the Oceania Champs, I would have gone, and, you know, it was the only time I had lost to him. But it was, you go from that immediate, you know, that down of, I've just lost the fight, I've now got to pick myself back up, otherwise I'm going home empty-handed. But again, a big part of the psychology of us is that we always leave the fight behind. You know, there's the old cliche, you're only as good as your last game. I don't believe that. I believe you're only as good as your next game. And we can see that. We can see people have had absolute shockers. And that's why in the semi-final, I had a shocker. I went out there and fought the flag bearer for Scotland. So, the hometown hero. And I came into the pressure a little bit and I wasn't patient and ended up losing. But then I quickly had to park that and it was all positive. And again, having Moira there, who the previous day won a silver, having her there to be like, hey, let's get on with this next one. This next one's the big one. You know, this is the job now. This is the focus. It can be a challenge, but when you've done it a few times, you sort of realise, hey, it's part of the sport. Yeah.
So you're in the process of building a gym. How is that progressing?
Yeah, so effectively, I like to be busy. And as I say, with my personal training business, we have a team of 14, soon to be 15 personal trainers, and we want to get them all under the one roof. Can't say too much about it at the moment. Again, a lot of the stuff I've talked about prior to this around, you know, really focusing on helping people is really, really important in that. And I think my ambition for it is that it'll be a center for people, first timers right up to elite athletes, but rubbing shoulders with successful people. And so I'm a big believer in that. If you're having a poor day, you know, go rub shoulders with someone that's having a good day, and you'll find that attitude changes. So the gym, if you imagine basically a 24/7 gym, like a Snap or an Anytime Fitness, meets more of a performance-based gym, like some of your better, say, CrossFit boxes. Sort of basically those two put together, but with, again, that sort of that ethos around the holistic well-being. Knowing people's names, birthdays, all that sort of stuff. Sort of a lost art of service, which we see as...
Such a lost art.
Yeah, it's not as prevalent as it used to be. It's those things that make all the difference in life, you know. And I think a comment I mentioned to you a few days ago is that, you know, if the cleaners in our gym aren't happy, we're doing something wrong. And it's a case of just having that positive place where people see it as being a destination. So hopefully by middle of next year, it'll be up and running or very close to being up and running. But again, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, so sometimes I delay things to make sure everything's, you know, all the cogs are turning in the right direction.
Nice. So, last question. 2020, Tokyo, is it?
Yeah, Tokyo.
Is that in the Costa plan?
I'd be lying if I said it wasn't. I did, as I say, I did retire after Rio.
Yeah, I was going to say, you just come out of retirement.
old habits die hard, you know. And so basically there's different prongs to it. But I retired because it was like, no, it's time to start giving back to other people. But, you know, when there's a fire, the fire was burning in the belly still. And I was very much investing myself into my athletes. And, you know, we are now the strongest club in New Zealand based on results and medals and members of the New Zealand team. But what's even better is that we've now got coaches coming through that can lighten the load for me. I am definitely more on the veteran end of the spectrum. So, there is maybe about 5-10% of judo players on the international scene are my age and will be my age, you know, when 2020 rolls around. But what I've pretty much decided is that if I can work towards that and aim towards that, then I'll bring up my guys to do the same or 2024 for them. So, you know, the official line is that I'm taking that competition by competition, but I can tell you right now that on my computer is a detailed plan of the exact steps and financial breakdown to get towards Tokyo. So, I think it's a goal, it's an aim, it's a challenge, but it's one of those ones that, again, I'm going to take, it's the official line, a competition at a time, because, you're missing out onto Olympics, you don't take things for granted. And you realize that anything can happen on any given Sunday, things can go wrong. So if I, again, enjoy the journey and, I do the right things, then I think 18 months out, we'll know for sure that it's going to be a goer. And as I say, hopefully we can finally get there as an athlete.
I look forward to seeing you action that plan and seeing how far you can take it. I just want to thank you, first of all, for your hospitality that you and Moira have shown over the last couple of days. Really appreciate it. But then also I want to thank you for sitting down and just talking about some of your experiences and being able to link into how, as educators or teachers, that we can incorporate some of those aspects. And I really like how, for you at all, it's never about Jason. It's about your family. It's about your athletes. It's about Christchurch. It's always how you can contribute to your tribe, and I think that's really powerful. And I think we can all learn a little bit from just take stock a little bit and think about the fact that it's not about us, it's about other people and how, what we can do for other people and how we can contribute to society. And I think that's really cool. So yeah, really appreciate your time, and I even just in this brief 30-40 minutes I've learned a little bit more about you, and you've moved up a couple of rungs of my eyes.
We'll be back on that podium.
So cheers, mate.
Awesome.